Committee on Environment and Land Use. It is 8:38. And we're going to juggle around just a little bit this morning from our printed agenda. We're going to open with the public hearing on House Bill 2466. And then we'll go into a work session on LC 1465 and House Bill 2273. So we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2466. Because Representative Butler is here and we're accommodating his very busy schedule, would you like to read the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2466 changes the basis by which employers pay hazardous substance fees under the Community Right to Know and Protection Act. It specifies that employers must pay an annual fee to the state fire marshal when they're required to return a hazardous substance survey. And House Bill 2466 allows local government to assess hazardous substance fees to fund hazardous substance planning activities. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly, and we welcome Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Butler. I'm from House District 60. I continue to wear my beef. It's what's for dinner hat. We need to eat more beef in the state of Oregon, particularly in as much as the folks in Harney County will be losing an industry, which is the equivalent loss in Portland jobs of one industry dropping off nearly 9,000 employees. And so about all that we've got in the industry there, because we can't harvest our timber, will just be nothing but continuing to raise cattle, and we would appreciate everyone eating more Harney County beef until we can get something resolved for those good folks down there.
Now that the news is over, you're going to do the weather, too?
You bet. You bet. And then the sports will follow. The top and the bottom of the hour, Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I bring to you House Bill 2466, dealing with some hazardous substance issues, and this has raised a number of questions from a number of folks within the industry. There's quite a long and a varied history dealing with the hazardous substances, and I've worked closely with the folks from the propane industry, and in particular, Lana Butterfield, who represents the Northwest Propane Gas Association and their dealers. And I would appreciate it if she could have an opportunity to come forward to testify with me on behalf of some concerns that we have as we're attempting to address them in House Bill 2466, recognizing that there is a large group of folks that have concerns about the content of House Bill 2466. I would ask the indulgence of the chair and the members of the committee if we could perhaps revisit this bill in the form of with an amendment to, in the interim, study the issue of propane gas as a hazardous substance, because it, as a hazardous substance in the form that it was originally thrown into the Hazardous Substance Act, it is not. And based upon that, I would appreciate the opportunity to have legislative counsel work with Ms. Butterfield and have the necessary amendments drafted to 2466 so that this bill could bring together the folks within the hazardous substance, within the fire marshal's office and the other folks that control and monitor hazardous substance in the state, and be able to address the issue of why propane dealers were thrown in and propane was thrown in as a hazardous substance, because there's no place that is stored as a hazardous substance. It's not left over as a residue anywhere, and it needs to have additional work done, and we believe that this is an excellent opportunity to examine this in the interim. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd take any questions, but if I may defer to Ms. Butterfield, that would be appropriate too.
Any questions of Representative Butler?
Thank you.
We appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here today representing the Northwest Propane Gas Association. Along with the Pacific Northwest Paint Council, we are actually bringing two related bills to you, and the bill today deals with the Oregon Hazardous Substance Possession Fee. this hearing is good preparation for the hearing that you will have on Thursday, which focuses on one of the programs that is supported by this fee, the Toxic Use Reduction Program, and that is House Bill 2533 on Thursday. The hazardous substance possession fee was cobbled together in the waning days of the 1989 legislative session. And for those of you who have lived long enough to go through enough legislative sessions to realize, the last days of the session are no time to put together a fair and equitable solution. And in fact, that did not happen with the hazardous substance possession fee. It is a Humpty Dumpty scrambled egg mess that is rife with inequities, exemptions, and it has caught a few businesses in its grip, some unfairly so, and it badly needs legislative review. I have asked Bob Albers of the State Fire Marshal's Office to talk with you next about this program, because I think he is the only person in the state of Oregon who can adequately deal with some of the complexities that this program that are inherent in the program. The hazardous substance possession fee funds three programs. The Community Right to Know program is handled by the State Fire Marshal's Office, and this is basically a data information system that serves firefighters and the public. Two of the other programs are handled by the Department of Environmental Quality. The first is the Orphan Site Cleanup Program. The hazardous substance possession fee funds the interest on bonds that are sold to clean up polluted sites that are abandoned or whose owners are not willing or unable to pay for the cleanup. And the third program is the Toxic Use Reduction Program, which provides technical assistance for businesses that must file toxic use and hazardous waste reduction plans. Propane provides an example, as Representative Butler was alluding to, of why this overall funding mechanism is unfair, and there are many other examples. Our product is flammable. We do feel a very direct connection to the Community Right to Know program. We work with that program very closely and with the State Fire Marshal's Office, and it's something we support. However, propane does not cause orphan sites, and it is exempt from filing toxic waste reduction plans. Yet, propane is the number one substance billed under the hazardous substance possession fee, and 17% of companies billed for this fee are billed on the basis of propane. We feel like we are being taxed without receiving any direct services for two of the programs funded by the fee. I want to make sure everybody who has contacted me knows that the bill as it is written before you is not what I'm pushing. It is not what I intended, what came out of Legislative Council. Actually, we had asked them to base the bill on I believe it was 1995 or 97 bill that changed the basis of the fee from a hazardous substance to basically a data processing fee. What in speaking with Representative Butler, there are some other surrounding issues that have come up in addition. For example, the petroleum load fee has been under discussion. And we feel that the legislature maybe needs to take a look at this whole issue at the substance and the funding of the programs. This is a raw nerve issue. It keeps coming back because it's one of those funding solutions that never quite worked. So we would ask you to consider the amendments. I have asked for them to be drafted, but they're not here yet.
So. We understand, Ms. Butterfield, that there may be another bill coming very similar to this one.
2533 deals with the toxic use program specifically.
I'm going to recess the public hearing, and then we'll pick it up again in just a moment when we get done with some housekeeping that we have to do this morning. I'm going to close the public hearing, adjourn the public hearing on 2466, because we have some folks that need to get on to some other things, so we'll do some housekeeping. And we'll open a work session on LC 1465. Committee, I think you have a copy of 1465. And the chair would look for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move LC Draft 1465 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Zahner has moved LC Draft 1465 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Can I ask just a question? I'm having read it just to get an understanding. Does this add something or take something away?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative, what this bill does is neither add nor take away. It extends
the sunset. Something in existence.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, those of the opinion that LC Draft 1465 be introduced as a committee bill will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries, and LC Draft 1465 will be introduced as a committee bill. Let's see. Okay, we'll close the work session on LC 1465, open a work session on House Bill 2273. In this regard, we're looking for a Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have the Dash 1 amendment in front of us. On page 1, line 25, the term shall is deleted and the term may is inserted.
Any discussion on the amendment, on the proposed amendment? Do we have a representative of the Oregon Law Commission? Mike, just have you come up to see if there's any questions from the... Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission, Greg Mao, Attorney of Stories and Oregon Law Commissioner, Associate Dean David Kanegi from Wyoming University and Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission.
Committee, any questions in regarding the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, didn't we go through this last session, this may and shall?
We
back
did.
Back and forth, back and forth. Are we still there? I mean, it only took us a couple of years to work that.
You have two attorneys to your right. They could probably explain the difference between shall and may. And then we have three more right in front of us. So.
We have sufficient attorney power here today, I think.
Would either of you care to address that question from Representative Zahner? The difference between shall and may.
Just say no.
It doesn't matter to me. I just trying to make life.
I move the amendment to 2273.
Representative Greenlick has moved that we move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2273. Do we have a discussion? Mm-hmm. Representative Doyle.
And another question from the panel.
Right ahead.
When we discussed this last week, I thought there were more issues than just this one that you were going to be taking back to your committee. Can you get just kind of a sense of what happened over the
Sure.
Topic?
Chair Girard, Representative Doyle, members of the committee. At the last hearing, the issue was raised, I believe, by the Farm Bureau as to whether inspection should occur prior to a permit being issued for the underlying activity. Subsequent to the hearing, a separate issue has arisen as to tort liability for property owners. The issue of changing shall to may is a relatively, in the view, I believe, of the commission, a relatively minor change. The other two would represent significant substantive issues, and perhaps Dean Kanegi can address how the Law Commission functions, but in general, our work group on this issue represented a constituency in which you had both property owners and governmental bodies, and the ultimate bill that came out represented a resolution of some competing interests. We are not equipped in the time we have to go back and sort of reconstitute and renegotiate and start over in terms of our process. The permit requirement would represent a major change in Oregon law, because at the present time, and the case is State of Oregon Department of Transportation versus Schrock Farms, which was a 1996 case of the Oregon Court of Appeals. It is not necessary to have permits even in place, even to do condemnation, because the permits frequently follow the condemnation. And if you had to have the permit before you even did the inspection, you would really get into a circular situation. So at least it would be somewhat difficult to work, and in any event, it would represent a change in the law. So that was not something that those of us who are here championing the bill felt that we would be able to accomplish with the Law Commission. The other issue of property owner liability, interestingly, is an issue that the Law Commission has. We have a work group formed on this issue of property owner liability because it creates all sorts of problems and confusion in Oregon law. But it is a much larger issue than the issue of pre-condemnation inspections. And if you notice in Bill 2273, sections 21 through 30 are the conforming amendments, and the only reason I point those out is that the situation already exists under present law, where a number of governmental bodies already have authority and already go on property to do inspections, and the sort of the issue of liability of property owners is not really created by this bill, and it certainly won't be cured by this bill, but I personally believe it would be more effective to have a comprehensive bill looking solely at the issue of property owner liability in a number of contexts for where you have people going onto property for different purposes. So I don't know, Dave, did you want to add something to that?
Simply this, that
could you identify yourself?
Thank you, and excuse me, Mr. Chair. Dave Kanagi, Associate Dean, Willamette University College of Law, Executive Director, Oregon Law Commission. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, simply wanted to add this thought, that the work of the Oregon Law Commission is to bring before you what we believe to be the best solution to the particular problem over which we were given the charge of making a fix. The legislative process is indeed the place where, if additional issues need to be addressed or should be for political reasons or other appropriate reasons brought before the committee, so be it. But the commission itself will not be in a position to endorse nor not endorse those kinds of amendments. As was pointed out by Law Commissioner Mao, in the case of the tort liability issue, we think a comprehensive review would be a much better approach to dealing with any issues raised as to landowner liability. We have an existing work group in place to take that comprehensive look. It is an enormous area of the law dealing with what happens when people enter property, and the status that they are given determines the amount of liability to be imposed, but this bill would not be the place to do it.
Any other question? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think actually the issue we dealt with last session was the may not, shall not distinction, but my question is about what this change to may does, because we had a lot of discussion at our first hearing about the language of the bill seeming to say that the court had no discretion to set standards or refuse to grant a court order granting access if the property owner didn't want to give access. So is this change to may intended to let the court have the ability to refuse to grant that order?
Yes. Chair Gerard, Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee, that is correct. On reflection, and I think as I'd indicated in my testimony last week, did not think it would be advisable or perhaps even possible to review all the grounds. But those of us who are on the work group, and I did canvass the work group after the session, would agree that there are certainly circumstances where an order should not be granted. You could have a body that is exceeding its condemnation authority, trying to condemn something it has no authority, no legal ability to condemn. I can't necessarily articulate all the situations, but there are certainly some. There could be a particular problem for a particular property where there'd be a legitimate reason either not to inspect at all or not to do it at a particular time. I believe that would be best left to the discretion of a court, and the intent of the amendment is to ensure that it is a non-mandatory situation.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Don Schellenberg, Don, you had the original, I think, question in regarding shall and may. You're okay with it? Okay. So we have a motion in front of us to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2273.
Motion.
I think we already have them. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we'll call a roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenleck.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gerard.
Aye. The Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2273 is adopted, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2273. To give you folks, what we're going to do now is go back to House Bill 2466. If we have time left this morning, we will take further testimony on 2369, but we will not be voting on either one. I have a real voting work session on either 2466 or 2369 today. 2369 will be brought back next Tuesday for a work session.
In 2273, will that be? Is that scheduled?
Okay, so we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2466.
Yeah,
Jim Craven.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, Oregon Council. The AEA is the nation's largest high-tech trade association. And I guess the role that I was asked to play here today is the gray old man who was present at the creation of all this Humpty Dumpty scrambled egg mess, to quote my colleague, Ms. Butterfield. I just want to give you a real quick grounding on this issue. There's going to be further discussions, amendments, and other bills on this whole area. Because I know none of you were present in 1989 when this was cobbled together. Just to revisit history real briefly, in 1985, Oregon passed what is known as the Community Right to Know and Protection Act. Now, that's a scheme that is managed by the Oregon State Fire Marshal, and it was passed in 1985 with really no permanent funding mechanism. I think they borrowed some money from the fire insurance premium tax or something like that. And that's a program where companies in Oregon report their use of hazardous chemicals. The fire marshal keeps track of that. One of the key reasons our organization supported that was it is critical information for emergency responders. When a fire rig rolls out to an industrial facility, they have the ability on an online basis with computers to, as they go out to respond, to know what's inside that building, particularly if it's on fire. I mean, there are sometimes when you want to go in and put out the fire, sometimes the data says, quite frankly, let it burn because it's too dangerous for the responders to go into that facility. So we thought that was, you know, by and large, that's a good program, and it helps protect public safety and such. 1987, the Oregon legislature passed its own Superfund law. You know, Superfund is a federal scheme about how do you clean up hazardous toxic waste sites when there's nobody around left to pay for it. Portland Harbor may or may not be an orphan site, subject to determinations of whether there are still enough responsible financial parties to help clean up that site. So in 87, Oregon passed its own Superfund law and said that we'll go clean up these hazardous waste sites that are sort of left around with nobody to go pay the bill. Again, with no financing mechanism, how we were going to pay for those cleanups by DEQ. And then in 1989, we came up with a third new idea, which was so-called Toxic Use Reduction Act, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about that on Thursday in the committee here. That's a program, it's an Oregon-only program, that requires certain businesses that use hazardous chemicals or produce hazardous waste to do systematic planning to how they will reduce their reliance on chemicals and reduce their production of hazardous waste. It's an Oregon-only mandate, it's not tied to a federal program. And so in 1989, we had three big ideas, all sort of baby programs just getting started and really no way to pay for them. So we had a nice long 6-month conversation about how to do that. I would remind you that at the time we had a Democratic governor, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate, and those of us in the business community were basically asked, how would you like to take your medicine, not whether or not we were going to take it. And it was a collegial process. I don't think anybody walked away from that feeling they had been totally burned or totally rolled over. And what happened was we created this hazardous chemical possession fee. Basically said a whole broad range of businesses in Oregon who use certain chemicals would pay a fee based upon the volume of the chemicals that they used. And then we would take that money and divide it up three ways. We'd give some to the fire marshal to run that community right to know program. We'd give some to DEQ to run this brand new toxic use reduction program. And we'd put some money in the bank for DEQ to go out and sell bonds to clean up hazardous waste sites. We thought at the time that trying to raise enough money in real time to clean up even one site, you know, you're talking $5 to $10 million perhaps to clean up one toxic waste site, maybe it'd be better to sell bonds to do that so we could get going on some cleanups, and then we'd use this fee to pay the bond debt service. So that's really where this fee came from. It was put together in one big bill, House Bill 3515, and I think as Lana said, the waning moments of the 89 session. And the fee has been in existence since then. It's got lots of wrinkles that the fire marshal's office is here to answer any questions you may have about it. There's been lots of issues about equity. I mean, propane, there's no orphan sites created by propane, but there's a lot of people that pay based on nitrogen, and there's no toxic waste sites based on nitrogen either. So it was the art of the possible. Those equity issues were there from the beginning. They're still there. We've tweaked it over the last 14 years, and I think the state fire marshal has done a reasonably good job of listening. We've had at least two interim work groups to try to make it better, to address some people's concerns. I know we had a hearing here maybe 10 years ago where someone came in and let go a helium balloon and said, there's no helium orphan sites either. And the balloon shot up, the helium dispersed, burst and said, where's the orphan site based on helium? Because in the way we built this fee was you'd pay on one chemical, the largest thing that you possessed. For many people, those are compressed gases. They use a lot of nitrogen. They use a lot of helium, whatever. There's been allegations over the years. You can ask the fire marshal whether indeed people pay based on kitty litter, whether people pay on sand, dust, dirt. I mean, there's lots of things that, for certain reasons, are hazardous. If you have enough dirt in a building and there's not a good air circulation, people can die. I mean, so it's not that these things are ludicrous. Lots of things are called hazardous in the industrial world because under certain circumstances they are. I mean, a compressed cylinder full of nitrogen, if the thing got in a fire, could become a missile. Now, nitrogen is what basically what we breathe. It's not hazardous in basic form, but if it's compressed and it's in a cylinder and the building goes up in fire, that's a hazardous substance. So there's lots of these issues. You'll hear about them as you move forward on this. And I think the answer is that after 14 years, it probably deserves another look. Both the programs deserve certain look. You know, should we keep programs just because we started them? And is there a better way to allocate this? It's all a game. It's not a game. It's serious business. But it's a game of how do you allocate the cost, who pays, who doesn't pay. And there's always winners and losers. If you carve out one group, the rest of the people left have to pay more. If you go, base it on more than one substance, some people go up, some people go down. It's been an interesting juggling match for all these years. And I think what, you know, the proponents of the bill are asking you to take a look at this again, basically for you to know something about this program, because it predates all of your tenure here in the session, and there's lots of people in this room and in the building who've got some history on it, and I'm sure they'll have their own wrinkles and such. This bill, as drafted, AEA doesn't support for lots of technical reasons, but I'm not sure we're really debating whether to move 2466 as printed, so I'm not going to, you know, bore you with lots of those details. But there are there's lots of ownership on this, and there's lots of help in the building to help you work through this, and we're here to help you a little bit with the history and then help you with how we move forward. So I would urge you to, you know, if you haven't heard from this from constituents, maybe that's good. You know, if you haven't gotten a lot of calls about this terrible, horrible fee and it's unfair, maybe we're not doing our job, I'm not sure, but so we'll look forward to seeing the amendments, and if it's a matter of moving forward and studying this a little more and making some decisions for the future, we would be willing to be part of that process.
Thank you for the history, Jim. Nice job. Any questions of Mr. Craven? Representative Ackerman.
I just need some information on the fee structure for these various hazardous substances. Is it based upon quantity, and is there a different rate assessed based upon the nature of the hazardous substance? Is there some differential between these? I don't get a feel for this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the expert is right behind me here, Bob Albers from the Fire Marshal Office, but the answer is yes, yes, yes. It's basically a matrix. Down the left-hand column is quantity, you know, 0 to 10 pounds, 10 to 100, 100 to 1,000, you know, whatever. And across the top, there's basically minimally hazardous, hazardous, and extremely hazardous. So we don't try to micromanage every chemical, but there's sort of at least three big clumps of hazardousness, and then there's a left-hand column of quantity. And again, the basic deal in 89 was to say, you know, in order to get the buy-in from the business community, people would like to know sort of roughly how much this cost us, and that was why we decided to base it on a single chemical. So you basically, and we had an existing reporting system that was getting up and running, so we overlaid a fee system on a data reporting system. Those of you, there's a certain analogy to, I know almost nothing about the pesticide use reporting debate, but you know, that's a more recent issue that's somewhat analogous to this, and I think the key difference is that program has, you know, debate's been around general fund to fund that program. In these programs, it was clearly who was paying, which is the private sector.
I want to follow up. Could you tell us where propane is on that matrix that you just described?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I'm going to let Mr. Albers do that. Thank you.
Could I? Representative Zahner.
Mr. Chair, who collects the fees? DEQ?
I'm going to turn around. They go to the Department of Revenue? Right. Department of Revenue administers. The fire marshal figures out on an annual basis what that matrix looks like and what the numbers are in each one of those boxes on the matrix. In other words, 1,000 to 5,000 pounds of nitrogen, you know, across the two lines, the fee is X. And then the Department of Revenue actually collects the money. And then because all those dollars are allocated to three different programs, and the allocation is done as part of the Ways and Means process every biennium, there's an expenditure limit that controls how much those agencies will get from this fee. And then basically it's the fire marshal's job to crank up the fee structure to generate the money that Ways and Means says each of those three buckets gets per biennium. So
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the amendments of 402 on item 2, what's amended is a statement, what's taken out is a statement that says the fees based on the aggregate amount stored or used at the facility, and what's added is a statement about based on the amount of hazardous substance reported on the fire marshal's survey. Are those two different things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the deleted language was the key part in 89, the single largest substance.
Right.
So, and what this bill language does, and I'm not sure anyone's here absolutely advocating the boldface type, but it says that it will be determined by a formula. The formula is to come. We're not sure what that formula would be. It would be probably if this bill were to pass as printed, I'm sure we'd have a work group. The fire marshal has been really great over the years in convening the parties here to look at stuff before it just gets enacted into administrative rule.
Follow up, sir.
Follow.
But my question is in one case the language is about what's stored in the facility, in the other case the language is about what's reported in the fire marshal survey. Does the fire marshal survey report everything, or intended to report everything that's stored at the facility, or is it subset of what's stored in the facility is reported on the fire marshal survey? That's
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, again, I think I'll defer to the person who runs the program. I'm getting a little rusty on this thing.
Thank you, Jim.
Is that a dangerous habit? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Just to let you know, the people that were present at the creation, our hair was all one color when we started this, so we're all getting older here. Thank you.
The committee will recall that we had Ms. Butterfield here, but I did not give the committee an opportunity to ask her any questions. If there is a question for Ms. Butterfield, we'll recall her. All right, seeing none, we'll go to Bob Albers.
I don't get a copy? Representative Gerard, members of the committee, my name is Bob Albers. I work for the Office of State Fire Marshal as the Hazmat Services Manager. As the Hazmat Services Manager, I provide administrative oversight for three of the State Fire Marshal's programs. One of the programs is our Regional Emergency Hazmat Response Team System, our Community Right to Know program, and the Hazardous Substance Possession Fee program as well. I've got some written statements that I've provided for you that actually provides an overview of how the fees are assessed, and it also outlines some of the fairness and equity issues that have been brought up over the years. As Mr. Craven indicated, the State Fire Marshal's Office had a hazardous substance information reporting program prior to the implementation of the hazardous substance possession fees. 1985, the legislature passed a law that said that the Fire Marshal's Office would survey Oregon businesses to identify which facilities had hazardous substances, what quantities they had, and what the hazards were that were associated with that. They defined a hazardous substance as any substance that the manufacturer is required to develop a material safety data sheet for, as established by occupational safety and health requirements. So as to what is reported to the fire marshal's office and what is considered hazardous is any substance that that is required to have a material safety data sheet developed for it. The fee itself is, the first criteria is to whether or not a company is subject to the fee, company including governmental agencies. Governmental agencies and private industry are subject to this fee. Question number one that has to be answered is, do they submit a hazardous substance information report? If they do, then they are subject to the fees. Then the fee, if you turn to the last page, you'll see an overview of this. The hazardous substance then is based on the single highest maximum quantity substance that that company reports. If the company reports 20 substances, the one that they have present in the highest quantity is the one, by law, that the fee is assessed on. If a company has one substance, and that substance represents their highest max quantity substance, that is the substance that they are billed on. The amount of the fee is determined by two factors. Factor number one is, what is the quantity? The second factor is, what is the hazard rank of that substance? 1989, when the fee went into effect, there was no hazard rankings involved. It was strictly based on all substances were considered the same. Because one company said, wait a second, my propane is not as dangerous as the arsenic poison over at this other facility, or our acetylene is not as dangerous as a poison gas, but yet we're being billed the same thing. What we did is we proposed legislation the next year that established three hazard rankings. One, it's minimally hazardous, generally hazardous, very hazardous. It's all established in administrative rules. So as Jim did, or Mr. Craven did a very good job of explaining the matrix and how the actual fee is determined. It's actually, there's about 300 individual fees within the matrix, and depending on how much you have and what the hazard ranking of that substance is, then determines whether or not your company is going to be assessed a fee, or your entity. The fee that is assessed is in reality three separate fees. One billing. There is a fee for the Community Right to Know program at the Fire Marshal's Office, the DEQ Toxic Use Reduction Program fee, the Department of Environmental Quality Orphan Site Cleanup fee. Three separate fees, all billed on a single bill on an annual basis. What we do on an annual basis is we look at the data that is reported to us throughout the year. We identify what the amount is that the companies have reported and what the hazard ranking is, and we then take and say, okay, this is what the fee schedule needs to be. The Department of Revenue actually sends the billings out. Department of Revenue collects the revenue, and then the Department of Revenue distributes it to the different agencies. Our agency, our office, deals with the request for reviews. People make mistakes on the report, billing errors occur, whatever the case might be, we deal with each of those particular issues. The Community Right to Know fees and the toxic use reduction fees range from $25 to $2,000. So if a company were to get a toxic use reduction fee, they could get a toxic use reduction fee for $2,000, a Community Right to Know fee for $2,000. And the orphan site fees range from $25 to $9,000. So in reality, a company, when they get the billing, they could get a billing for $2,000 for Community Right to Know, $2,000 for toxic use reduction, $9,000 for orphan site. That's going to be on the way high end of this. That's worst case scenario. In general, petroleum products are exempted from the hazardous substance possession fees, because of the constitutional restriction on taxation on petroleum related products that are not going to be used for highway related issues. So that is an overview of how the fee itself is assessed. 1993, as was pointed out, the legislature had industry reps that came before them and said, look, the hazardous substance possession fee has been put together, and we've been being billed for this for 4 years. We've dealt with it, you know, it's been modified administratively, but it's not fair and it's not equitable. And there was issues, they said that it just wasn't fair the way that it was set up. What the legislature did in 93 was to direct the State Fire Marshal's Office to meet with the industry reps, those folks that were receiving the billings, and those folks that were that were not receiving the billing and to identify what the issues were. If you look down about three-quarters of the page on the front page, you'll begin to see what some of those issues were. I won't take and go through all of them. Some businesses, the issues that they had were some businesses, some small businesses pay higher fees than large businesses. Some companies pay multiple fees on the same substance. And any one of these, I'd be more than happy to take and explain how that occurs for you. Some companies with only one substance pay fees, while companies with hundreds of substances don't pay fees. Companies with no toxic substances pay a toxic use reduction fee and an orphan site fee, when other companies that have toxic substances don't pay any fees. And only 6,000 companies of the 48,000 companies that we survey, annually we survey 48,000 companies in the state to find out what hazardous substances they have. Of that 48,000 that we survey, only 6,000 of them are actually assessed the fee because there's exemptions and because half of them do not have reportable quantities of hazardous substances. They don't have at least 50 gallons, 500 pounds, 200 cubic feet. And there's 34 separate issues that were identified as a result of the advisory group that we convened in 1994. And all 34 of those issues continue to exist today. And we validate that based on the phone calls that we receive on an annual basis from the when we assess the fees. The advisory group, when we put this group together, it was a year-long study. We surveyed folks that were being subject to the fees. Bottom line, the root problem that was identified is that basing a fee on hazardous substances has an inherent negative loop where it winds up the dog chasing his tail. You continue to loop back into the same problems that you have with the current fee system that we have. At that time, that group recommended that the hazardous substance possession fee be changed to a hazardous substance information processing fee. The bill that you're looking at, it's my understanding from Ms. Butterfield, was actually intended to propose a processing fee that would change the basis from being how much hazardous substances and how nasty is it to how much information has to be processed for your particular facility. In order to, if that ever occurs, that in itself would eliminate the problems that we currently have with the hazardous substance possession fee. And with that, I'll just conclude my formal information for you and field any questions that you might have.
Questions of Mr. Albers, Representative
Ackerman. Albers, in your last page of your testimony, you say legislative action is needed to make the fees fair and equitable. This cannot be done by administrative action, yet I note in Section 4 of the bill, and specifically ORS 453.408, the Department of Revenue, in consultation with the Fire Marshal's Office, has rulemaking authority. Now, I usually characterize rate making as an administrative function. I really doubt whether this committee or the legislature would ever get that task done because of the difficulties involved in setting forth a fee structure. With that in mind, why do you feel that the administrative procedures, rulemaking procedures, are inadequate to solve this problem?
Representative Ackerman, Representative Garrard, that statement is made based on the fact that we cannot administratively change the basis by which the fee is assessed. In statute, the law says that the hazardous substance possession fee is required to be assessed on the single highest max quantity substance that the company reports. As long as the substance is, or as long as the fee is based in that manner, There is no way for us to eliminate the fairness and equity issues that have been identified by the various advisory groups and the various people that have been involved with it.
Okay, one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Well, if we took that phraseology out of the Act and gave the Department of Revenue more administrative discretion, wouldn't that be the answer to the rate-making process?
Representative Ackerman, Chair Garrard, I'm not sure that I understand the question.
You said you're statutorily constrained from implementing the assessments through the rulemaking procedure. If we took that statutory restraint away and gave you greater administrative authority, wouldn't that be the answer to providing a hearing and a process to have a more equitable fee structure rather than having a legislature try to wrestle with that?
Representative Ackerman, Chair Gregg, if I understand your statement, if you just eliminated the requirement that the fee be established based on single highest max quantity substance and done administratively, I haven't looked at it from that perspective, but I believe that that would, I mean, what we would do if that occurred is we would go back and assess the fee based on the amount of information that was processed or take a look at that particular avenue.
Thank you.
Okay, just to point out, one of the issues having to do with the with this fee. Currently, as I stated, only 6,000 companies out of 48,000 companies pay a hazardous substance possession fee. One of the objections to going to a processing type fee is you actually spread the cost of the fees out over 48,000 companies versus 6,000 companies. So the long and the short of it is you wind up with more fee payers.
Plus, Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, but Section 6, which repeals ORS 453.414, is in actuality exempting local government.
No.
It's repealing the local government exemption.
Representative Garrard, the section, I'm not sure which part it is that you're referring to, that it exempts local government. Jim, help me out here.
Well,
I looked it up yesterday. Chair, members of the committee, ORS 453414, you know, you hate these bills that says is repealed. It forces you to go get the statutes and look it up. That's known in the building as the Tom O'Connor Memorial Clause. Tom at the time was working with the League of Oregon Cities. What that section does, and this was part of the original, it was either in 89 or 91, it said if a local government is required to use a chemical by other law, then the local government does not have to pay based on that chemical. And here's the example. A local sewage treatment or water treatment plant that is required by law to chlorinate its water, and sometimes would be using very large quantities of chlorine to treat its water supply because it's required to, then the city of X doesn't have to pay based on chlorine. It was just a little narrow exemption argued and accepted by the body on behalf of local government. I can't remember, I don't know why that's even in this bill to exclude that exemption. But I guess the argument would be if we were moving away from assessing chemicals based on, assessing this fee based on chemicals to processing of reports, that exemption would no longer be required because we wouldn't be taxing based on chemicals. That's just a guess, but I don't know why council's done that.
Thank you, Jim. Representative Gard, Jim's correct. In the current statute, it states that if a governmental agency is required to use a hazardous substance in order to perform its function, then that particular substance is exempted from the hazardous substance possession fee. In this, what this would do is that would repeal that. There, if you based it on what the if you were based it on what originally was intended, a processing fee, there would be no need to take and have that that clause in there anymore.
I believe Representative Richardson has the. Do you have that particular ORS?
Thank you. Okay, and that clarified the questions that I had. I wanted to make sure that this wasn't going to impose a substantial fee on local government without them having an opportunity to come and testify about it. But you're saying this is basically a cleanup process and provision. We're removing a statute that no longer would need to be in here because of the provisions of this law.
Representative Richardson, Chair Garrard, as this bill is currently written, this bill's got major issues all the way around. in terms of, and when I was asked to come and testify today, or to provide you information, was to provide you some background on how the program, how we assess the fees, what the issues were with the, because it's my understanding that this bill was to be, was a proposal was to amend it so that you would establish a interim task force to take a look at it. This bill, if you all were to want to take and move forward with this, I'd probably come in here and wouldn't have any hair left, because this would amplify the problems that we currently have probably 100-fold the way that this bill is currently wrote.
Okay, follow up. So House Bill 2533 is the bill that Jim mentioned. Is that the one that we need to be seriously looking at before we take any action on this bill?
House Bill 2533 addresses the toxic use reduction program and the funding for the toxic use reduction program. And I think that I'd probably be better to allow the folks that are presenting that to take and talk to you a little bit about that. I think that you can actually take and address 2466 if you decided that you wanted to take and make an amendment and establish an interim task force, even aside from your discussions on 2533. 2533 in itself has some far-reaching impacts, negative impacts on how the fees are assessed.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you. With the fee assessment methodology that you're proposing, not looking at the actual bill we have before us, but what you understand we could go to, what's your understanding as far as the amount of dollars currently being collected, and what would this do to, I guess, revenue for the state? I mean, are we increasing revenue, or is it revenue neutral?
Representative Doyle, Chair Gerard, the law states that the amount of fees that can be assessed cannot exceed the amount that is legislatively approved for the three programs. So there would not be more revenue generated by changing the basis by which the fees are assessed. The same amount of revenue would be generated, assuming, of course, that the programs are funded at the same level they are now.
Representative Vina.
Yes, while we're waiting for this to be clarified, you mentioned in your testimony that that company can store substances they don't use in order to avoid paying higher fees. And I understand with the Matrix thing, I would pick out the cheapest chemical, and I would store 1 ounce more of that than of the most hazardous I actually use. And that must be the sort of thing you're talking about here. Does that actually happen, and isn't it possible to stop that from happening, because that's a clear subterfuge if that is really going on?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Gard, there is a classification of hazardous substance known as a registered chem. And there are certain substances that have been classified as a registered chem. And those substances, as an example, sacrete concrete, bags of concrete, if you have concrete on your site, and if that concrete is the highest max quantity substance that you have, then that particular substance would be what you would be billed on, and you would receive a $25 fee for that. If you, let's say that you had an equal amount, or let's say you had 500 pounds less of methyl ethyl bad stuff, as an example, and the fee on that was supposed to be $3,000, you'd still only pay a fee on the $25. $25 because your highest max quantity substance would be the concrete. There, for us to go out and to make that determination as to whether or not a company needs the concrete, we could never validate one way or the other as to whether or not they need that. We have had companies that have, through our appeals process, have told us that those are things that they can do in order to avoid it. So based on that, that's one of the ways that a person can take and get a much lower fee if they desire.
Follow up.
Yeah, I understand if a concrete company has concrete, or if somebody's building a new building, they have concrete. But if one of Mr. Craven's electronics companies decides to just have concrete in every one of its bags of amounts of concrete in every one of its facilities, it would seem to me that would be a rather easy enforcement matter. And is there any attempt to look at that at all?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Garrard, we have not went out to companies specifically to take and do audits of them to determine whether or not they actually are using the concrete that they say that they are using. There are other substances. There are other substances besides concrete that fall into this category. Ureas, as an example, if you have urea, which is a type of fertilizer, and you have, if that happens to be your highest max quantity substance, you're going to pay a $25 fee. There's actually about 60 different substances that fall within this category. Anybody that wanted to could take and purchase those products, maintain those as the highest max quantity substance that they have at their site. How often this happens, I cannot provide you any hard information on that. We could certainly take and go out and try to find it, but I think we'd be hard pressed to prove that somebody was not using the concrete. I think it might be a little easier to do, but something like urea and some of the fertilizers, we'd have a real difficult time taking and showing that they didn't actually use it.
Representative Zahner.
Mr. Chair, mine is to do with revenues. I asked a question a while ago, who collected it? I see the revenue department is owed $342 million plus spare change. How much are you in there? You know, you send out the bills, you don't get the money. What part of that $342 million might be fees that you haven't been able to collect that they haven't collected for you? Does that make sense?
Yes. Representative Zahner, Chair Guard. The hazardous substance possession fees are dedicated funds and are not included in the $342 million. I believe those are general revenue funds. The collections on these funds are actually pretty good. When we calculate the fees, we incorporate into it about $380,000 per biennium for the Department of Revenue's collection costs. And we also calculate into it a 5% no pay and 5% for adjustments that have to be made. Department of Revenue has a real good collection records on this. I would be willing to bet that it's less than 5% in no pay. Yeah.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, Bob, Representative Richardson.
Can I ask just a series of quick questions just to clarify some things?
Go ahead.
I wasn't clear from the answer to Representative Doyle as to the amount of money that this generates. Can you just give us an idea?
Representative Richardson, Chair Guard, the Toxic Use Reduction Program is budgeted for $1 million per biennium. The Orphan Site Cleanup Program is budgeted for $1,005,000 some odd change. The State Fire Marshal's Community Right to Know Program is budgeted for approximately $3.3 million. So you add the three of those together, comes into about $5.3 million that is generated per biennium through these fee assessments.
Okay, now what I heard earlier was that this would change the payees of this fee from $6,000 to $48,000. Is that correct? And if that's correct, wouldn't that lessen the amount that each of the payees are paying then?
Representative Richardson, Chair Guard, if the fee was based on how much information is processed, those companies that are currently paying fees, some of them would pay significantly less. Some of them could pay a little bit more than what they pay now, but that would be at the $6,000. The majority of the $6,000 would wind up paying less fees. But again, what you would pick up, and it depends on how you were to structure the fees. If you were to only assess fees on those companies that actually have hazardous substances, about 20,000 companies would pay the fee, and that cost would be spread out over the 20,000 versus spread out over 6,000.
Okay, and my final question is, notwithstanding what you said in response to Mr. Greenlick, or Representative Greenlick's question, if there was an amendment that said that payment, that in assessing the substance that is being stored upon which the fee will be attached, that substance must be used in the normal course of business. Would that be something that, are you saying that that wouldn't be able to be implemented?
Representative Richardson, Representative Garrard, if that kind of language was put in there, that would maybe make a change, and it would be, again, it'd still be difficult to take and approve one way or the other as to whether or not it would be more difficult to take and prove. Okay, anything's possible.
For a moment, if there was a signature that you had to sign saying, under penalties of perjury, I hereby certify that what we put on this form is an accurate representation of the substance that we're storing is used in the normal course of business.
Representative Richardson, Chair Gerard, I believe that most of the companies that, in fact, the vast majority, less than 1% of the total population of businesses would ever intentionally take and do something of this nature.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that being the case, then it wouldn't hurt to do that. And then if you had an electronic company that had a huge amount of concrete, then maybe you might look into that. I mean,
Representative Richardson, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Sorry. Any other questions?
Thank you, Bob.
You betcha.
For the committee, a point of information, House Bill 2533, which is coming to this committee as a relating clause of hazardous substance bill. So it would appear that we have two bills that we can probably merge somewhere along the line. Terry Witt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Terry Whittem, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I am one of those people that Jim Craven talked about that's getting a little gray because we've been working with this issue for some 14, 15 years now. I will keep my comments very brief. I basically support the comments made by many of the previous people testifying that what we really need to do is look at the law, determine parts of it which need to be modified, parts which maybe need to be just deleted altogether. The one I bring out specifically is the fact that in 1989, when the fee mechanism was attached to the community right to know, that's when the programs were attached that are funded to go to DEQ, namely the Toxic Use Reduction Program. And I would just like to reiterate some promises that were made back in 1989, and that is that the Toxic Use Reduction Program really was a program that should only have a life expectancy of about 10 years because it's a self-eliminating program. As businesses are basically consulted with and given information on how to reduce the amount of toxic materials they use or the toxicity of the materials they use, that over a period of time this program would basically eliminate the need for itself by eliminating the toxic materials that are used in business today. I won't say a promise, but that was something that was told to us some 14 years ago. And the program hasn't gone away yet, and I think it really does need to be looked at very seriously. I would like to maybe clarify one thing that may perhaps put some of the comments and discussions that have been going on, particularly with Mike, into perspective. The program is a little easier to understand if you realize that the hazardous possession fees are assessed based upon the largest inventoried material for 24-hour period or more. This is not a total of over the year. It was originally designed to be a inventory used by first emergency responders to an area. The idea being that if I had over the course of a period of time, I may use 100,000 pounds of chemical X, but it's important for the emergency responder to know what the maximum quantity that I would inventory of that material for any 24-hour or greater period over the course of a year, because that's what that emergency responder could in fact run into if they come to fight a fire. They don't care what your average inventory is. They don't care how many pounds you process for an entire year. All they're concerned about is what they might run into at any given point in time if they respond to a fire. As a result, that number then becomes an absolute. It's not an average. It's not a total. So, for example, the discussions that were talked about, I think Mike used the term urea. If a company stocked urea and didn't use the material over the year, it obviously could be its largest single aggregate substance. But what normally happens, and where I think some of the I'll say inventory control takes place, is that, for example, let's say I could be a company that's using chlorine gas. You can purchase chlorine gas in a 90-ton tank car, park it on a rail siding, and draw off of that 90-ton tank car for the entire year. Your largest quantity would be when that tank is full, 180,000 pounds, 90 tons. What they can do to minimize their impact would be, rather than bring that chlorine in a 90-ton tank car, they could bring that chlorine in 10,000 pounds at a time every month, so that their maximum inventory might be 10,000 pounds, not 180,000 pounds. And that's just inventory manipulation. It's not really stockpiling a material that they don't use. It's just inventory management. And that does, in fact, I think, create, and I believe it's in one of Mike's points of concern, is that by doing that, what we're doing is we're putting more hazardous materials on the road. If you go from one shipment per year to 12 shipments per year of a hazardous material, now you're dealing with transporting these materials through many times urban areas. So you're trading some particular types of hazards for others when you get involved in inventory manipulation. But it's perfectly legal because the law is based upon largest hazardous substance inventoried for a 24-hour period or longer during the calendar year. So so that, I think, puts it in a little different light than just looking at the largest substance, the largest amount of material, hazardous material, that you have over the course of a particular year. I would like to also offer our services to work with the Fire Marshal's Office and any work group to find some solution. Again, I think the root problem of the inequity in this system is the fact that when the Community Right to Know program was started back in 1985, and the hazardous substance reports that were being submitted specifically for emergency response. They were not being generated for a fee basis. And to me, it's kind of like looking at the, let's say, the draft registration process, and then somebody saying later on, well, you know, we could use that for voter registration as well. Well, you can't, because it's designed to collect data for a different purpose, and although it may have some correlation, it doesn't really fit one for one, and I think that's where we're at right now. We're trying to use a program that was specifically designed to deal with emergency response. We're trying to use it as a broad-based mechanism to spread equitably fees based upon hazardous material, and it's a square peg in a round hole. And so we need to either shave the corners off the peg or square the corners off on the hole, one of the two, because it doesn't really fit. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, question of the witness, and I understand your argument regarding the inequity of the fee structure. However, as I read from line 25 on page 1 of the bill, what is being repealed is language which bases the fee upon the aggregate amount of the single largest annual aggregate substance reported. So my question to you, am I reading the record correctly that this inequity is repealed in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I believe the way this bill is written, that would change that requirement. That is correct. It's my understanding, I think, in several previous individuals that testified, including Representative Butler and Lana Butterfield, that this particular bill, the way it is drafted, was not as the proponents had requested. So I think at this point in time, anyway, it's not the bill draft that they propose to work from, but with specific reference to that question, your answer is correct. That would change that reporting requirement.
And just a follow-up question, then, would it be correct to say that that would then give the Department of Revenue and the Fire Marshal greater administrative authority through the rulemaking process to reconfigure the fee structure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that would, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
Theolinda Jones. Okay. Glenn Potter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My name is Glenn Potter. I work for the City of Eugene for the Fire and Emergency Medical Services Department, and I operate the local Toxics Right to Know program for Eugene, which was enacted in 1996. Considering some of the testimony that you've already heard, I'm going to keep my remarks brief. I did prepare a written testimony that outlines the potential effects of HB 2466 as it's written on our local program. And we would like you to consider the effects on local programs as you deliberate over hazardous substance fees. We are in full agreement with the possibility of a study of this issue. We'd be pleased to participate in such a study if we're invited. Just very briefly, then, I refer to first full paragraph on the top of page 3, which addresses local government fees. It says a local government may assess a hazardous substance fee only if certain conditions. The Eugene program has been the subject of considerable litigation and legislation and studies at the state and local levels since its inception. We've taken many steps to comply with existing state law and with the decisions of the courts, excuse me. The proposed language here, again, as it's written, concerns us because it would eliminate the funding mechanism for our program as we see it, or it would require an entire reworking of the Eugene Toxics Right to Know program. In the previous paragraph, the existing law, it says a local government fee based on quantity can only fund certain activities. We have complied with that by basing our fee on the number of employees of a reporting business. And we have 39 companies that this affects, by the way, in Eugene. The new language would require that we could only assess a fee based on amounts reported to the state fire marshal, that the fee could only fund activities that would be of a planning nature and would entirely supplement the programs that the state has, and that the state fire marshal would do our billing for us and we would pay him for that service. So again, that would require an entire reworking of Eugene's program. In 1999, the legislature adopted House Bill 2431. That regulated Eugene's program and other local programs that might be proposed, in that it placed a cap on the fees that we could charge and reduced our maximum fines that we could levy. We were in compliance, or were in the process of complying with all of some of the various other provisions of that House bill. It was passed in 99. I think I'll end it right there unless there are questions from the committee about the Eugene program.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you. Are there additional fees being assigned to Eugene businesses beyond, I guess, the fees that are imposed statewide, or does Eugene just get a different amount, you know, based on their program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Doyle, the latter. The companies within Eugene are required to comply with the state program and also with the Eugene program and pay fees to both.
Representative Zana, did you have a question?
No, I'm just...
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just a couple of questions for clarification, Mr. Potter. When you state that the city of Eugene is precluded for assessing fees based upon quantities of chemicals stored, what's the basis of that statement or rule?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I appreciate the question. The language, the existing language, going to the bottom of page 2 of the bill, local government assessments based on quantity or the hazardous substance survey shall be used solely to supplement and not to duplicate the state's programs. The courts have held that Eugene's program does, in some respects, overlap with the state's programs. Not entirely, and of course we argued otherwise. Our program requires considerably more detail than the state's. The state fire marshal requires reporting in ranges above fairly substantial thresholds. The Eugene program requires reporting of practically of every molecule of this stuff, down to a threshold of 2.2 pounds. And then in 4 different input categories, 11 different output categories, to the water, to the air, into the product, it's still there at the site, what have you, such that those two totals balance, again, to within a kilogram.
Just a follow-up. Are you saying that there's a court decision that precludes the city from assessing it on a quantity basis, or there's some implication in the bill that makes that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, yes, sir, there is a court decision that we feel precludes us from charging on a quantity basis under existing law.
Okay.
Under the new language that's proposed in 2466 here, sir, we don't feel that we could assess a fee at all unless we entirely reworked our program. This is about a $100,000 a year program. There are 73 companies that pay fees and 39 that file reports, and that's another long story having to do with two different sets of criteria that we were forced to adopt.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Potter.
Thank you.
Ted Hughes. I know he was here. Bob Danko.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. I, along with Mr. Craven, was involved in 1989, and I think my hair also shows it. I was involved with the work group in 1993. I've basically been the department's representative on this subject and similar subjects since the mid-80s. And again, I'll be happy to continue doing that during the next interim. We are neutral on the bill. The department's neutral on the bill. We really don't, as you affirm, we really don't have any say in how the bills are assessed and who pays and that. The two programs that it funds, the two laws, the orphan site cleanup law it partially funds and the toxic use reduction law are very important laws to the department, and the funding is very important to the department. I believe the bill on Thursday, HB 2533, is more specific to the toxic use reduction law, and I'll be here Thursday to talk in detail about that. But we will be happy to continue being part of the discussions, and if there's an interim work group, we will obviously be at the table also.
Any questions of Mr. Day? Thank you, Bob. Bob Leiper?
Sorry,
I'm interrupting. Okay. Committee, we have on the schedule to hear House Bill 2533 on Thursday of this week. So we'll kind of hold back on any particular action at this point until we see 2533 and are able to receive some testimony on that. Then we can look at maybe combining these two bills in some way. Anybody ever find Ted Hughes?
There he is.
Ted Hughes.
You're on, Ted.
I thought maybe you went to Las Vegas, Ted.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. This is Ted Hughes representing
Pacific Northwest Paint Council. As you see, we're one of the sponsors of this wonderful bill, House Bill 2466. We love it. Aren't you glad we introduced it so we can get in this kind of discussion? I mean, it's very enticing and interesting. It has been a problem, and the reason we put our name on this bill with the Propane Dealers Association, it has been a problem, as you've already heard, for ever since its inception, and I think it's time that we take a look at the need for these funds and how they are assessed, and that's why we were so happy to step up here. I'm not going to share the history with you. That's already been done very adequately by my peers. So I will have more comment probably on House Bill 2533 or the combination of the bills, whatever you choose to do. But it is an irritant with the business community, continual irritant. In deference to DEQ and the fire marshal, they have recognized that and they have fashioned their approach and their fees increases to keep us happier than we were when we started this debate. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions of Mr. Eagle? Seeing none, thank you, Ted. And we will close this public hearing on House Bill 2466 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2369.
Haven't lost the audience.
And because of the 100-mile rule, we're going to go with Mike McCarthy. Mike, we thank you for being patient, sitting here. And
where did you come from?
Good River.
Oh, yeah. That whole country. Well, you see that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to get on today. My name is Mike McCarthy. I farm in Parkdale, Oregon, in Hood River County. I raise pears, apples, cattle, hay, and timber, and I oppose any changes to the farm dwelling requirements on high-value farmland. I was a member of the committee that studied the $80,000 test in 1994. It was called the Technical Resource Committee. It was a committee of LCDC, and we developed the $80,000 test for high-value farmland. We studied all the options, including gross income tests, net income tests, tests based on IRS tax returns, capability tests, minimum size requirements, template tests, and many more. The committee was made up of two farmers, myself and one from Eastern Oregon, Jim Johnson, who was with DLCD and now is with ODA, Jim Pease from OSU, Thor Thorson from Soil Conservation Service, and a couple of county planners. After extensive discussion and review that took over 6 months, the committee decided that a simple gross income test was the best option. We still believe this is the case. It's simple and easy to calculate, and it's possible to administer by planning departments, and I think that's very important. It gets very complicated, any other thing you try to do. It's meaningful because it's tied to significant real income produced by farmers desiring a dwelling. It does not rely on a subjective evaluation by planning departments. It cannot be manipulated as easily as some of the other processes. This is a major flaw of the capability test or other tests that rely on a farm plan. Individuals with extensive resources that have no desire to farm can create scenarios to meet the requirements. So I hope you'll oppose House Bill 2369 and do not allow a weaker test that will destabilize the farm zone. You might consider increasing the $80,000 amount. It's been a number of years since it was proposed, and because of inflation, it would be a good time to consider increasing that dollar amount. I really wonder why you want to change the $80,000 dwelling test. An old saying farmers use all the time, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I really think this applies here, that there's many other more important things for you to consider, and I think it's better left the way it is. I think it's really important that we maintain a strong Oregon agricultural economy. And I think one thing through this poor economic times, at least in my industry, which is the food industry, we're doing very well at this time. We've had a really good year. Ag is still strong in Oregon. In my own operation, I'll spend over $500,000 in the local economy this year for labor and ag inputs. I hope you'll think about maintaining agricultural efficiency. Large parcels are the most efficient to farm, but small parcels are extremely important to farmers like myself in Hood River County. I farm a number of parcels. The largest one I farm is 155 acres of pear trees. The smallest one I farm is 10 acres, and I have several 10-acre parcels that I farm. They don't have dwellings on them, but they're very important to my overall farming operation. I hope you will consider not increasing conflicts. More homes in the farm zone will cause conflicts, especially when the farms aren't really farms. And I think that's the thing you have to realize, is if you propose another test, many of these dwellings that will be allowed will not be farms. They'll be basically non-farm dwellings. And because of the cost of these dwellings, at any later date, a farmer won't be able to afford these parcels to continue farming or to farm those lands. So they'll essentially be taken out of agricultural production forever for each house that you allow that's really a non-farm dwelling. That investment that a farmer makes to meet that $80,000 test means that that farmer is really committed to farming, and that he will be more likely to understand the business of his farm neighbors. Compatibility tests are no measure of whether owners will really commit to the land and will be compatible with uses in the zone. So in summary, I hope you will not change the $80,000 test, and I oppose this bill for that reason. And if you have any additional questions as you work through this, I'd be glad to participate in any way I can. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. McCartney?
I have one.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your position. I represent a district that has a lot of farmland and have sent out the information on this bill to a number of farmers in Southern Oregon and have gotten back their responses, and some are in favor of it, and some are opposed to it. And the concern that I have, and what I'd like to ask you, is first of all, my understanding of this bill is that it doesn't do away with the $80,000 rule, but it merely adds to it other considerations. And although you're in your farming situation, you know, you have productive land, you have several plots, would you think that it's unfair if if you take into consideration the type of soil, the farming that is not, that may not even be taking place on this land, the fact that there are other homes all around a piece of property, a situation where the only reason that a home cannot be built is because it's EFY zoning and it doesn't generate $80,000 worth of farming? I mean, can you see that in some circumstances it might be appropriate not to have just a hard and fast $80,000 rule?
Well, as I understand the laws, there's a number of other methods presently where you can get a non-farm dwelling. That you can get non-farm dwellings or other dwellings. And I think for the farm dwelling test, I think it's really important to maintain that same, that $80,000, and not allow other tests to come into play. I really do think it's important because it's really the best test. And I think partly the reason maybe we've gotten ourselves into a situation where we have these scattered few parcels out there is because we haven't done a good enough job in the past of protecting the farmland. We've allowed too many dwellings to come into the farm zone already. And that's really what we find in our area. It's very difficult to farm with these other dwellings around. And I don't think that means, though, that we should now take the stance that we're going to allow all those parcels to be gobbled up because we perceive some problem with them. I think what that'll allow to happen is we'll just have more of this problem in the future, where we have small parcels of farmland that are getting to the point where it's difficult to farm.
Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy, I might add that there are circumstances. As an example, if you can't get water to farmland, you don't have farmland anymore. And maybe something should be done to be able to give a little more flexibility to the landowner to do something with that property, other than farm.
Well, as a farmer, I guess I don't agree with that. You know, I'll farm till I die, and I love farming. And
but you don't have any water, you can't farm.
Well, in Oregon, and especially in Western Oregon, that's still not a problem because we have adequate.
We have another side of the state here.
Sure, and a lot of those wouldn't qualify as high value farmland, I suspect, and would have other avenues that are already legal to site those dwellings.
Well, they used to be. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I?
Oh, Representative Freeman.
Yeah, I too have a very important part of my district that's high use farmland, probably the $80,000 limit in Western Washington County. And I'm having a little problem with this being a sort of farm property rights issues. And I'd really like you who are here on one side dealing with the kind of property rights that you as a farmer believe are important, maintaining your rights to farm your land as appropriate. Can you just comment on this kind of split in the agricultural community? We are talking about farm homes in this definition. We're not talking about non-farm dwellings on property that's now been decided isn't exclusive farm use, and how do you sense others of your neighbors feel on this? You sense, and it's clear you're talking about Western Oregon. We might have a different concept, and I would ask the same question. Is this a major split in the farm community among your neighbors, as you know them, among people who farm?
Right. I think there is somewhat of a split, and I think we all know that. And I think one of the primary reasons is, though, that those of us that are committed to the land and are committed to farming, for example, my family started in the Hood River Valley in 1909, and we believe in the land, and we believe that the land should be preserved to farm. And even if there's a time next week or next year when it's not real profitable to farm, we believe that those lands are valuable 5, 10, 15 years from now to farm. Most of my friends who don't believe, as I do, in strong land use planning are not committed to the long-term farming. They're committed to more of a subdivision-type mentality. And really, that's where we see the split. If people that believe in the land long-term are more supportive of land use planning. Those that feel like maybe it's time to retire and get out and they want to maximize their returns at this time start to look for other ways to divide up their land or get dwellings on their land. And so that's, I think, mostly where we see the division.
Thank you, sir.
Very good question.
Thank you,
Mr. McCarthy. Tom Brawley.
Good morning.
We have 1, 2, 3, 4. We have 5 more people to speak in about 15 minutes. So if you can hold your comments to around 3 minutes, I'd appreciate it so we can get everybody in
there. I'll do my best.
Thank you, Tom.
Mr. McCarthy, I hope you all realize that Mr. McCarthy's act is a really hard one to follow. That was genuine. It came from his heart, and he had some good facts and issues that all I can do is take my hat off to him and thank him for that presentation, because it was full of good facts and issues. If I can help answer a few of your questions that you footed to him, I have a few answers that I'd like to back him up with.
You need to identify.
My name is Tom Brawley, working up to that after I got your attention.
You could do that first now.
Well, this is my attention getter.
Oh, okay.
My name is Tom Brawley. I'm a full-time farmer from down south Marion County here. We run a family operation. I'll explain it to you in a little bit. I want to say that I hope you folks realize you're not the first ones to wrestle with this problem. And you can see that from his testimony. And it was the process that came up with this method was long and lengthy and very arduous and did take public input also. This committee listened to many, and I was one of the ones that gave public input and testimony to it, that we were in fact making our $80,000 on 80 acres and could do it. And so that was several years ago. So you're not the first ones to look at this. There are many exceptions that are often put forth, but generally they become the rule. And we can look at the 2-acre parcel division, and that was to be an exception, but now it's the rule. They just take it for granted. They can divide down to 2 acres in smaller parcels. It used to be the exception. And so exceptions I do have concern with. I'd like to also answer the split issue, and I am certain that when all of you were elected, none of you were elected on a total majority. Anytime you have people, you've got differences of opinion. But in this issue, there are many wolves in sheep's clothing. They masquerade as farmers. They'll tell you they're farmers, but by and large, many of them are not. The water issue, I know, is a problem in some parts of our state. I think much of that's a federal issue and needs to be dealt with at the federal level if you're lacking water. So I'd like to come back to say that it seems to me we're divided into two ways. We've got to preserve the land base for a very essential function. We all eat, and we're trying to produce food and fiber for the people of our state and our nation. How do we so we've got that issue, and we compare that with how do we permit hobby or small farmers to begin? And it's possible. And I know you've heard testimony from people that have started with little or nothing and worked their way up to full-time farming, and they're in this room right now today. If you look in the papers, you'll find that there are many, many parcels available that are 5 to 20 acres. And they're out there with and without homes on them. There are thousands of acres in every county that are divided down to 5 and 10 acre parcels. They're already there. We don't need to create more. They're available. Our farm operation, we raise hay, grain, and grass seed. But we also raise specialty crops on parcels that vary from 50 acres down to 2 acres. And we do this at a distance from our home farm of usually 2 miles or more. And this means that we've got to move our implements along roads that are becoming more crowded all the time. And they're becoming more crowded by people who are used to living in town and used to jumping in their car and zinging into town to get a pack of cigarettes or whatever. And they're very highly disturbed by our wide implements moving slow. Now that's just one issue. We've got so many other non-compatibility issues that we face. And I could list them, and I know they've been listed for you, and we have a list of them that are beautifully written and I can make available to you. The reason we do this at 2 miles plus is because we use bees to pollinate our hybrid crops, and we have to be this 2 miles. It's an old method, but it works to pollinate our crops with bees. So the basic concept that it seems to me you're faced with is whether you want to look at a land and say this is potentially a piece of ground that's potential. It has potential to grow a crop. You want to look at that and say this has got potential. Or you want to look at it and say, as it is now, this is a successful and it's proven. And there are a lot of people that talk a good fight. But when it comes down to the action, and that's an old-time saying, not necessarily on the farm, but it works, because you've got to prove yourself, you've got to prove that this can be done, and that's what this $80,000 does. So when the small parcels are important to many farm operations. The method of proving it, not just saying it can be done, and then giving a lick and a promise, but proving it. So that's what I'd like you to consider. And this method of proving it and being successful is also an old-fashioned method, but it's time-honored. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Brawley? Thank you, Tom. Appreciate you coming in. Mark Novizicker? I think I messed that up, Mark. Apologize for that.
No problem. It's not the first one. Thanks, Mr. Chairman and Committee, for letting me testify. I'm Mark Novizicker from Lebanon, Linn County area. I'm mostly grass seed farmer. I farm about 2,600 acres of grass seed, hay, cattle, and a few other smaller things. I've watched this $80,000 rule be badgered different times by different people, and I haven't come up with anything better. I think it's very important that we maintain some sort of standard out there to eliminate houses for housing sake. And I think this $80,000 rule is the best we've got so far. Big thing that bothers me in farming is conflicts with neighbors. We don't need more houses. People that want to live in a new house, there's lots of opportunities to buy old houses, build new ones there. There's opportunities to live in town. We don't need to use our farm ground for rural housing, and that's really what it comes down to. I've started farming, rent a piece of ground, dad loaned me some equipment, kept renting ground, and I can live anywhere. That was not a problem. Some people oppose this, say, you know, we've got to go build a new house, now we want to farm. It's not the way you start farming. And the two gentlemen before me did a very good job, and I don't need to repeat a lot of what they said, but it's, if your heart's in it, you'll find a way to farm. The problem has been in the past, if your heart's in building a new house in the country, you'll find a way to do that. And this $80,000 rule has restricted that. Just because your piece of ground doesn't have water on it, does that mean it should be housing? I don't think so. I think, you know, let me farm it. I've got conflicts and things all the time going. I've got a dozen different landlords that own small pieces of ground. My largest landlord, my mother, it owns 300 acres. My smallest one is 2 acres. But if I've got a 2 acre, a 5 acre, and a 10 acre together, and it abuts a 40 acre, I've taken out the fences, and now I've got a 55 acre decent field I can farm. You know, these small parcels are farmable. I farm about 18 fields, I believe I counted, that are smaller than 10 acres. Some of them are along in a 100-acre field across a creek and through, you know, the fence or somewhere is a 5-acre parcel. So those are farmable. It's surely not ideal. The big fields are better. But the size is, just because it's only a certain size doesn't mean you should have a house on it. I just see so much abuse out there, and we've got to have some strong standards. I've got one neighbor that's really upset about this $80,000 rule. He's a full-time good farmer. He's retirement age. Over the years, over the 35 years he's been my neighbor, he has bought parcels, built houses, subdivided, built. He's got 10 homes on his property he owns and rents out. Now he's mad because he can't get his house. He wants to build a new house for retirement. Well, replace one of the old ones. And I think that's where the split comes in the community. Their heart's not in it. It's the money is what they're looking at, or it's the developer mentality. The conflicts I've had have just over the years, from kids using my fields as playgrounds, they leave debris in the fields, dam my ditches, build forts and haystacks, knock haystacks over, motorcycle riders. I've got one kid, 2-3 years ago. I didn't catch him until he had a well-worn tracker on a 60-acre field. He saw no harm in that. He'd lived next door, and he thought this was a great motorcycle track. We just go on and on. I've had a lady 2 years ago called me up at 6 o'clock in the morning saying, what in the world are you doing? This airplane, I was having a crop duster fly some chemical, only way to get it on a sugar beet field. The airplane said, I thought, oh, no, he sprayed her house. And my kids are sleeping in the backyard, and I thought, oh, no, this is horrible. She says, you woke my kids up at 6:30 in the morning. He says, I know airplanes have to turn, but do they have to turn over my house? So this is the mentality of the new people coming into the community that haven't grown up there. Their parents, you know, weren't farmers. We're getting so much of that. We need to restrict that. There's just so many conflicts we have. I've got a neighbor, bought a house, wanted another house. They would not allow it. $80,000. Well, he already had his one house. Well, he agreed to tear down the old house. So he built a $600,000 home in the middle of this 70-acre parcel. The day after he moved into it, he applied to keep the second one anyway. Well, they didn't allow it. Well, now he's using it in his office anyways. And it just adds to those conflicts of more people, more everybody that has a home in the country has the right to have a second dwelling if you've got under a hardship case. Anybody over 60 years old, and so that's your parents or grand. And there's a lot of that going on. So all of a sudden, every parcel has two homes. And if you're farming full-time, you've also got the option to have another farm dwelling. And so there's another chance to have another home. And it's just, we've got to restrict this. We can't continue on with just allowing more homes because that's what somebody wants is to put another house out there. I had a different testimony, but those guys followed it, did a good job ahead of me, and I just would like you to really consider how we can protect our farmland for farming and not for development. I take about 80% of the city's of Lebanon's sewage sludge on my fields. The biggest parcel where most of it goes, another guy wants to build a house across the street. You know, we can't have it both ways. And I guess I'll leave my testimony with that.
Any questions? Thank you, Mark. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for your testimony.
We have four more to speak. If the and I know we have a floor session at 11. I'd like to finish up this public testimony this morning if I could. So, again, ask our prospective testimony if you can say what you came to say, but do it as concisely as possible. The chair would appreciate it. Bob, your turn. This time you got the right bill.
Thank you, Chair Garrard.
That's close enough, as Mark.
Members of this committee. I will try to keep this short. I previously gave you a written testimony on House Bill 2137. And just quickly, I have 24 acres in Marion County. I'm not able to build on this, even though I bought it in March of 1985 because of the $80,000 rule. This bill before you seems to me, and I'd like to simply state at the very outset here, I am totally in disagreement with the statements made by the previous speakers here on the $80,000 rule and the protection of farmland. I'm not really for this bill, however, because it seems to assume that I have the right to build on my property, and I do not. It gives the right to build on my property to my spouse, child, parent, step-parent, grandchild, grandparent, step-grandparent, sibling, step-sibling, niece, nephew, or first cousin of either, etc., etc. And goes on for 21 pages of gobbledygook saying how you can build essentially a second dwelling on the property. But I can't build a first dwelling on the property. And so my issue is with the $80,000 rule and the fact that I have been denied the right to build a house on my property that I had when I bought the property originally. I want to farm it. I bought it because it was half wooded and half cleared in cultivation, and I intend to keep that cultivation, and I intend to keep those woods. I like the woods. I like the wildlife in the woods, but I cannot build on this property because of the $80,000 rule. Thank you very much.
Any questions of Mr. Leifert? Thank you for coming in. Carney McLaren?
Chair
Chair Gerard, members of the committee, I can be very brief. I just wanted to supplement my testimony of last week with some more written information for you from the Census of Agriculture. We've had some discussions about productivity of small farms, and I thought this background information might be of interest to the committee. I simply want to submit it into the record.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren.
Thank you.
Jim Welch.
Chair Gerard and committee members, I'm Jim Welch representing Oregon State Grange. I want you to know we, with a 19,000 member association or fraternal organization, do have people on both sides of this issue also. You would expect that out of a farm-based organization. But we also have very specific legislation that we develop within our own organization. We do that annually at our state convention, and it states very specifically that the Oregon State Grange lobbied to repeal the 80,000 income test. This was passed amongst all our delegates that were there, and of course there is a majority of them that wanted to see this 80,000 income test repealed. Some of the issues that we've heard about, I understand those who are farming. I grew up in farming timberland in West Lane County. We still live there. And I understand listening to some of these people, but it doesn't all add up. You know, it sounds like, you know, I'm not in my backyard continuously, and I've sitting where you did respectfully, Mr. Chair, listen to it year after year. And a lot of it is that, you know, we have our 300 to 3,000 acres, and we don't want anybody else out there. They have to buy more or lease property, and you have to understand that if it's going to be deemed developable land, that the price goes up for it, because it is. And they can't buy it then for farmland values. And that's one of the biggest issues. They want that all around them protected at lower values. I would too. As a farmer, there's no doubt I don't want to buy it at a higher price. But we have the encroachment of larger cities from Portland, Eugene to Medford, all up and down the I-5 and very good agriculture land. The issue is that we see the cities and population growing. That's going to continue. That's something we can't stop. We do need the farm products and forest products out in our rural areas also. So we have to come up with some sort of a compromise here, because we have those who love to live in the cities and those who like to live in the rural lands. And we have a lot of what I call tweeners, and plenty of those people in between. They are, a lot of them want a 5-acre piece and just one residence on it, maybe 20 acres. A lot of these we call hobby farmers. But they have just as much right out there. But what we have failed to do is to establish that there is buildable lands out there. We have not started building new small communities in areas that are less than high-value farmland. We could do that. We have identified those areas. It could be secondary lands. We can call it anything we want. The fact is, from county to county to county, we need to do a better job identifying, maybe along soil types or whatever. We could also, as a suggestion, we could also make sure that those who live, as I do, on my 5-acre piece, keep it in resource management. I raise timber on my 5 acres and has paid for all of my property taxes in the near 20 years that I've lived there. And we have a garden which supplements probably a third of our food cost. And believe me, in the economic conditions of today in the state of Oregon, that is not small potatoes. There are plenty of us out there that can supplement our income off of timber, off of farmland, and it does mean something to our economy. And we have right to farm legislation that takes care of the conflict of neighbors who don't understand how important it is to be able to let a plane come in early in the morning and spray your field. We have plenty of laws out there on the books today to take care of those people that don't like or want to speed around farmland and aggressively take on passing when they shouldn't on the back roads when they're going around farm implements. I've passed those for years, and you just have to understand that you have to do it safely, and you take them into consideration as they're moving equipment from property to property. We have plenty of laws to take on all those issues, and we have right to farm in this great state. So, Mr. Chair, I say that we have a lot of work to do, and this issue has been before us many times, but there are people that have a right to build at least a residence on their property and want that right. And the $80,000 income test that removes that right is not a fair one at all. It's ludicrous. It doesn't make sense, because there are ways to supplement our income and ways that help our economy and the ways that we can maintain these resource lands without an $80,000 income test. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Mr. Welch? Thank you, Jim. I remind you, too, that this bill doesn't remove the $80,000. It just adds another manner in which property could be acquired to build what you want to. Ron Eber. This is our final guest.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I have some written testimony that will be handed out to you, and then I have other handouts depending on what kind of questions you may want to ask me today about this standard or at a later time. Simply want to point out that the department has significant concerns about House Bill 2369 and its potential effect on Oregon's farmland base, and we do not support the bill as drafted for three reasons. One, because of the impact it would have to the farmland base by adding more houses. It would lead us to a test or standard for the review of farm dwellings that has been used before and shown not to work. And three, we believe it has a problem as drafted in terms of leading to a rule that would violate the statutory provision that it's intended to implement. The first thing I would like to do is simply note that there are currently 15.5 million acres of private land zoned for exclusive farm use in Oregon, and exclusive farm use zoning has been on the books since 1961 and 1963. There are a lot of ways. You've heard a lot about the $80,000 test and how it is preventing development in farm areas. I would direct your attention to the chart that's attached to the testimony that shows the number of dwellings that are approved in farmland yearly. There are seven different ways to get dwellings in farmland. Counties report what's happening to the department on an annual basis, and we put out a report. And as you can see, we probably average around somewhere between 800 and 1,000 dwellings a year in our farm zones. Some of them are primary farm zones. They're either those that meet the income test or are on non-high-value farmland on large parcels. Most of the dwellings are either lot of record dwellings or non-farm dwellings. And as I think Mr. Nostinger pointed out, a lot of the dwellings of the total approved in the 10-year period from 93, almost 30% were replacement dwellings. So there are a lot of opportunities for dwellings on small parcels, on parcels that are not suitable for farm use within the farm zone. With respect to this particular standard, a capability standard, what we would refer to as the Promise to Farm standard, this was used extensively in Oregon from the late 70s into the late 90s, and in a study that was funded by the legislature in 1989, we went out and looked at the farm dwellings that were approved based on a capability standard. And what we found was that some 75% of those dwellings approved earned under $10,000 a year in gross farm income, and fully 37% didn't earn any income at all, so they didn't fulfill the promise, and there was not farming going on. And these small operations do not contribute and really support the agricultural economy of the state. They contribute less than 2% to the farm economy.
Mr. Eber, can you wrap up your testimony and say 5 minutes?
Less than that, Mr. Chair. The final point I'd like to make is that the statutory standard, which has been on the books since 1963, that a dwelling be customarily provided in conjunction with farm use, the courts have said that that means the land must be currently employed for farm use. A rule standard that we believe this language in this bill would lead to would potentially allow a dwelling if there was no farming occurring. And we see some problems in developing a rule like that in light of the current statutory language. So with that, I would simply point out that one of the other attachments to the testimony are the summary results from the study that was prepared in 1990 that then led to the commission developing the $80,000 test. So as written, we do not support this bill. We see it as having a lot of problems. And as written, I think the bill leaves some question as to whether or not you could still have a gross income standard, or whether we would have to move to a capability standard, and whether you could have both in place at the same time, I don't know. So with that, I'll leave it open to questions from the committee with regard to the commission's standards for farm dwellings or exclusive farm use zoning.
Any questions of Mr. Ewing? The chair appreciates your brevity, Ron, very much.
Understand
this morning.
I'm available any time to come back and answer other questions you may have. I think I gave Ray copies of the rules with an index on how to get through them yesterday.
We did. We are planning on having a work session on Tuesday of next week. So, seeing no further questions, we will close the public hearing on 2369 and adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Land Use meeting.